This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular program, I'm again truly delighted to have as my guest, the founder's historian, as he's known, or called with that title by the New York Review of Books, having won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Founding Brothers, the National Book Award for his book on Thomas Jefferson entitled American Sphinx, and an excellent book, I must say, almost with the same title, on His Excellency George Washington. Most recently, he is the author of American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies. In my view, the single most accessible and deepest text on the complexities of our nation's founding, that talks about, among other things, the two original sins of America that George Washington wanted to heal but was unable to in the historical circumstance, and that is the way we treated the Native Americans and slavery, how we treated the African Americans, and giving an illumination of where we are now as well. And so with that, I'd like to introduce my guest, Joseph Ellis. Joe, it's always a real treat to have you here in these dialogues.
It's always great to be with you and with your audience.
Barack Obama is the topic of this conversation and this dialogue, Barack Obama, past, present, and future. And we want to, I think, begin by focusing on his inaugural address, the way he introduced himself finally as the one president at a time when it was his turn at noon on January 20. He introduced himself to the country and the world with an inaugural address that had been much anticipated by everyone, including yourself specifically as an expert in this area. You had been called upon as a commentator in 2004 when the last president, the outgoing president, made his inaugural address. You have read all the inaugural addresses of previous presidents in your historical research.
It's true. It's a real chore, and it's not a particularly distinguished genre, but there are a few raisins in the dough, and I was anticipating that Barack Obama's inaugural might very well become one of the ones that were very memorable. You were there and heard it in person. I was watching on television from, believe it or not, Palm Beach, Florida, my initial feeling was some disappointment because it didn't have the rhetorical cadences and swing that I had expected. But I really, as he went on, I came to realize he was not intending to speak to the ages, but he was really intending to speak to the moment. And I think that if you sit and read it, it's really, really a profound statement. And in some sense has more of an impact as a read document than as a speech.
Very interesting that you say that, because I felt the same, even though I was there in, we might say, this huge transformational moment, the inaugural moment. I was within maybe 200 yards of the stage in the congressional guest area with an intimate crowd of other congressional guests numbering 240,000 of us, which was approximately the same amount of people that had listened to Martin Luther King's great speech in 1963. And so this time it was dwarfed by the number of people that were on the mall, extending all the way from the west side of the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial, estimated at over 2 million, approximately 10 times the amount of people that had been there in front of the Lincoln Memorial at the other end, listening to Martin Luther King. But his presence was very much in the air. Martin Luther King Day had been celebrated the very day before. And yet, I have to say that in that environment, as electric as it was really characterized more by a feeling of, I think, real unity and good feeling and warmth and openness among all the people present. In the area where I was listening, the congressional guest area, by definition, all 535 members of Congress had been allotted a same number of tickets. So everyone around me was literally from a different part of the country. All races, all genders, parents with children, elderly, people with canes, and so on. It really was a portrait of America. And yet, listening to him, only two or three phrases caught my attention, you might say, that stood out. But when I read the speech, just as you say, I thought it was an extraordinarily profound and eloquent document. And we note, Joe, that in that recent article on inauguration addresses in the New Yorker from last week, that originally inaugural addresses were really meant to be read. They were hardly ever heard by any large audience of citizens. There was one example of even an address that had been attended by 8,000 people, but because of the lack of broadcast facilities, which we take for granted,
didn't have amplification.
People couldn't hear a word. So really, the documents, in a sense, are best incorporated when read.
The Jefferson's first inaugural, which is one of the best, was delivered in a voice so low that nobody could hear it at all, and the members of the press were following it in the text that he had provided beforehand. So it was almost a read document as he was delivering.
And so I think here, one of the things that stands out when we do read the text of this inaugural address, in a sense, it really is, in my view, one for the ages. And it is, I think, something that is really masterful in the sense that he touches on the issues of the present moment, as you say, but it's very far from a catalog of policy issues and policy wonking, even though he does address each of the major issues of our time. But his very first sentence, he says, "My fellow citizens, I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you have bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors." And so right there in the very first sentence, he is acknowledging that we do stand in an ancestral lineage, really, if we think of it, going back well beyond that of the founding fathers and our nation itself. And he himself, of course, incorporates in his own DNA, literally, a global, we might say, lineage going back to the first inhabitants of the planet that came from Africa originally. And then at the very end of his speech, he does quote, not the obvious choice, given his own temperament and his association with Abraham Lincoln and his having taken the oath of office for the first time since Lincoln on Lincoln's own Bible, but he quotes George Washington. And you and I, when we spoke yesterday, you thought that was, and I agreed, very significant.
Yeah, Obama, a couple of things in response to what you were saying. Throughout his political campaign for the presidency, Obama has played down the fact, the self-evident fact, that he is the first African-American to be a serious contender and now the president of the United States. And in some sense, I think he trusted the reality of that to be self-evident again and didn't need to be underlined or to be referred to in any kind of rhetorically conspicuous way. And I think that he also felt that the problems facing the nation were sufficiently serious, and heavens know they really are, both in terms of foreign and domestic policy, that an inspirational speech might very well be the wrong note. It was a call to arms, if you will, for the American people. And as you say, everybody had been thinking that this was a moment akin to the one of 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt assumed the presidency, or Lincoln in 1860, 61. And those are the touchstones that everybody, including yours truly, were looking at. So we were thinking about Obama's speech. But Obama went back further. Obama went back to the real founding moment in the Revolutionary era, and again, uses history, he always has it right. And in this instance, he quotes Washington, who at Valley Forge is calling attention to the dire and near extinction of the Continental Army, which is about ready to starve or dissolve, Washington says, and the need to stand together at this moment. And in some sense, Washington was Lincoln's hero, and in that sense, there's a kind of lineage. And if you think about it, you know, here he is standing on the Capitol steps, looking straight ahead. And what does he do? He's looking at the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, and the crowds stretch that far back. So there's an incredible affinity between his words and the actual physical scene itself at that moment.
I think, in fact, it's very interesting to, in a sense, quote that part of the speech, because anyone who thought that eloquence was missing from the speech when they heard it will be really very, I think, pleasantly surprised when they read the text. And I'm going to read now the last three paragraphs of the speech. He says, "So let us mark this day with remembrance of who we are and how far we have traveled. In the year of America's birth, in the coldest of months, a small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shores of an icy river." Now here, of course, we are in the coldest month. It was extremely cold outside. It was said by the commentators on January 20 there in Washington, D.C., as I was bundled up with everyone else, that it was, I think, 23 degrees out or 28 degrees, but felt like 17 degrees. So he's setting the stage here for Valley Forge when he says, "A small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shore of an icy river in the coldest of months. The Capitol was abandoned. The enemy was advancing. The snow was stained with blood." And that's because, as you point out in your great book, American Creation, hardly any of the soldiers even had proper footwear.
Now, they had to cut up their tents to wrap them around their feet, their canvas shoes, and there really was blood on the snow. That wasn't just a sentimental affectation afterwards. The 6,000 troops that were there were in extremely serious condition.
And so here we are, thinking how cold we are, bundled up in our fleeces and our parkas and so on, and just it's almost unimaginable, the scene at Valley Forge, especially as you describe it in your book. And just now, Joe, people were literally in rags. Their feet were bloody, and they had really no protection against the cold, and there was no money for food. And in this situation, Washington sent forth a call to the Congress. And I'll continue now with Barack's text. After he said the snow was stained with blood, he then continues, "At a moment when the outcome of our revolution was most in doubt, the father of our nation ordered that these words be read to the people." And this is Washington now. Quote, "Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet it." And then, having made the analogy to our current unprecedented economic crisis for the last six decades, Barack continues, and this is his final paragraph. "America, in the face of our common dangers, in this winter of our hardship, let us remember these timeless words. With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations." And that's how he ended the speech. Now, I find that very compelling and at the same time not sloganeering. It may not be the soundbite that people had hoped for. Roosevelt's, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," which was not even his words, but was one of his advisors who he said he'd read it in a paper in New York a few days before, and it had a nice turn of phrase, and so he dropped it into the speech, and it becomes that by which we remember FDR. "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And in the Time magazine article on the anticipation of Obama's inaugural address, there was also a note that you quoted to me yesterday about JFK and how his famous line came from his own prep school days. To tell us
that
story.
That's not what your country can do for you. That's, you know, again, Kennedy didn't write his own speech. He probably had some role in it, but the Kennedy speech is usually considered in the top tier of inaugural addresses, and it was crafted almost as a series of quotable quotes, and some of them are quite memorable, but some of them dissolve and become less impressive with the passage of time, and especially after the body bags start coming back from Vietnam, the phrase, you know, we will pay any price, bear any burden, it's a real Cold War speech that it doesn't endure with the same. The rhetoric is wonderful, but the message is not as impressive in retrospect. I think that Obama's speech is exactly the opposite.
Namely, and I do too. Yes,
it's going to be a speech that didn't seem to have the kind of rhetorical brilliance at the moment. But the more that time goes on, and here we're only a few days later, beginning to see it. Is going to have an enduring kind of significance.
I believe that's really true, and it was exactly my feeling as on the plane on the way home I had the chance to read the speech, and I've read it now two or three times, and I feel I can read it many times, and each time there is another aspect of it which is, as you point out, enduring and really inspiring. And it was really his choice to actually consciously avoid a series of quotable quotes and sound bites that has been, I think, his rhetorical and oratorical power with the American people as a persuader, because it's much deeper than the kind of demagogic or quip kind of approach that doesn't necessarily lead people to longer or more enduring inspiration. It can actually be abused, that kind of reducing complex issues to a single phrase. And here, I think he says it very clearly. He does follow Ted Sorensen's advice, the person who drafted the original draft of John Kennedy's inaugural address, to keep the sentences short, not the 787-word sentence of John Adams at the one extreme, and not just a series of quotes either. And, you know, I had the same experience when I went to read Kennedy's inaugural. At the time he was assassinated, I went back in the emotion of that historical moment and read his speech, and I was shocked to see what a cold warrior speech it had been, because I remembered the charisma and the image of the moment more than I did the actual language of the speech itself.
You know, that's the only inauguration I've ever seen myself. I was a young kid, and I was living in the Washington area, and it was cold as the dickens, and my father worked for the Secret Service, and he got me a seat, and we walked along Pennsylvania Avenue, watched him seal up the manhole covers, and I remember listening to the speech, but that to some extent the high point of the Kennedy inauguration was Robert Frost's attempt to deliver a reading of his poem. He's the first poet that's ever invited to be part of the inauguration, a great one indeed, too, Robert Frost. And he couldn't, the wind was so blustery that he couldn't hold the paper, and he couldn't read it. And so eventually he just gave up and said, okay, I'm not going to read it. I'm going to recite another poem from memory. And he did, and it was the one that begins, we were the land before the land was us. It's a famous Frost poem, but it was a moment of natural eloquence, which I remember more than Kennedy's own words themselves.
And I remember that even watching it. That's right. And one of the comments that's been made among various commentators since Barack's speech is the sense that he did have a natural charisma in his own person. And that's actually what we remembered, we who were there. And interestingly enough, a caller has just sent a note in saying, somewhat finger-wagging way, it's President Obama, not Barack, not George, not Bill. And of course, that is appropriate to a certain extent. I remember one story where Jack Kennedy was walking across a golf course in Hyannisport, and some wealthy, well-heeled neighbor of his, who didn't didn't know him that well, came up and glad-handed him as Jack. And he found that offensive, and he felt that the dignity of the office should be respected, and he should be called President Kennedy to this person who was obviously trying to manipulate him in some particular kind of way. But yet I have to say that all of the people around me and the people in the subway and the people that I've experienced during the campaign, we love calling President Obama Barack because he does inspire a certain kind of feeling in myself and many other people and yourself, I know, Joe, of a kind of intimacy, an interesting intimacy that he is really a human being. We have a president here who has a kind of integrity of humanness. He began his speech by talking about, "I am humbled by the task before me." And one of the things that really struck me on the television when I was watching the music presentation that happened on Sunday at the Lincoln Memorial with Bono and a number of other performers was, as these people, these rock stars who are great celebrities in their own right in the popular culture, were waiting in line as he approached them to actually speak with him, I saw The Edge, who is the musical director of U2 and whom I met one time at a reception. We're talking about this man called The Edge, a member of the U2 band. And he's a very cool character. He's very dedicated to his music. He's the main, we might say, musical source there of U2, whereas Bono is the great performer and inspirational singer. And he has his little crew cap that he wears all the time. And he's very cool. But as Obama approached him, Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, approached him with his naturalness. The Edge broke into a great warm smile, and his face just shone, and his natural warmth as a human being came out, and he reached out and he hugged Barack, who let himself be hugged, and there was just a real intimate personal moment. It's not the kind of smarminess you get with certain politicians that kind of, you know, grab your right arm with their left hand as they're shaking your right hand and kind of give you that phony sort of intimacy to kind of work the crowd. This person, Barack Obama, has something about him that I find quite genuine and that really does inspire that kind of intimacy. So no disrespect meant here when we say Barack.
The president who conveyed that kind of intimacy more than anybody else in the 20th century for sure is Franklin Roosevelt. There's a famous story that when Roosevelt died, one of the people standing on the side of the road as the hearse was coming by was asked whether he knew Roosevelt, and he said, "No, I never met him, but he knew me."
And, oh, beautiful!
There was, I think, the fireside chats conveyed that, but I think that there was an understanding that, I mean, some of it is almost mystical, that Roosevelt was able to make people feel that he understood their problems and he had their interests at heart and he knew them. Obama has some of that, too. And it's in some ways it can be dangerous because you can become a Rorschach test for everybody's particular agenda, but I think it's an extraordinary political talent that at this moment in our history can serve an enormously useful purpose.
In fact, he's been called the great persuader in a way that goes beyond Reagan. He really does have the depth of Lincoln as well as the ability to speak with that kind of intimacy. And we do note in terms of this question of President Roosevelt, President Kennedy, President Obama, that both Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy were known quite affectionately and intimately as FDR and JFK.
Right.
We rarely hear people talk about President Roosevelt or President Kennedy. And the reason is that uncanny ability to make a connection with human warmth. Even Kennedy, as cool and elegant a character as he was, had this great intellectual curiosity and openness and a sense of self-deprecating irony. And we find that in Barack, as well as this depth of historical resonance and knowledge he has, that he can so eloquently bring into language that can communicate with everyday people. And one of the things maybe we might want to look at here is his way of honoring our military as part of our society, just as George Washington did. And here I'm going to quote from, again, Barack Obama's inaugural address. He says, As we consider the road that unfolds before us, we remember with humble gratitude those brave Americans who, at this very hour, patrol far-off deserts and distant mountains. They have something to tell us today, just as the fallen heroes who lie in Arlington whisper through the ages. We honor them, not only because they are guardians of our liberty, but because they embody the spirit of service, a willingness to find meaning in something greater than themselves. And yet, at this moment, a moment that will define a generation, it is precisely this spirit that must inhabit us all. And I think that is a very eloquent way of talking about the spirit of service, because in the whole era that's taken place in the last four decades since Vietnam, there has been a huge fissure in American society with respect to the military. It has been demonized by many. American policy, foreign policy, has been thought to be nothing but a trail of military depredation and economic exploitation of other countries. And while certainly those elements are there in part of the American presence abroad, and certainly exacerbated tremendously in the last 8 years, nonetheless, there is a real deep meaning to when we say the services, the armed services. It is about service to these larger ideals, and no one knew that better than George Washington, even at the time of our founding. As we find out in your book, Joe, and I would like you to talk about this, there was suspicion of the Continental Army, that it would be a tool of oppression, and so on. And the most honored president we have, George Washington, is someone who managed to actually not exploit his position as commander-in-chief or as president, but nonetheless struck a balance between what one needed to do to bring certain ideals and democratic processes into the world in that feudal monarchy that really dominated Europe at the time, and yet at the same time maintain the ability to have a government that could sustain itself. So talk to us about that.
Okay. Let me, Colin, you've said a whole bunch of things here, and I want to get to the Washington thing, because I do presumably know something about that, but I just want to also comment on the Barack remark concerning the military, because I think that since the creation of the all-volunteer army, which happened in the early 70s, military service has been something that the vast majority of the middle class of America has no familiarity with whatsoever. And we've kind of, what's the word, you know, when you send offshore, the military side of American foreign policy is...
outsourced.
Outsourced. We've outsourced it. And... the kind of students that I teach at elite liberal arts colleges have no sense of military service whatsoever. I mean, and the only time, I mean, you know, certainly we see on TV, we see the soldiers, etc., but the time that it always comes to life for me is when you're in an airport and a couple of soldiers in their desert fatigues come walking down the middle of the corridor, and you realize, oh my God, you know, I mean, and I just, you know, like, you just want to thank them. I think that Obama is going to have the courage to ask something of us. I don't think he's going to try to resume a draft, but I do think that this notion that there's a cause greater than self is something that's going to be a centerpiece of his presidency, and military service is part of that. I've always been an advocate, even though I know it's politically impossible, for some sort of mandatory national service, military service being only one form of it. And I really do think there's a hunger out there in that generation. And it's the generation that has discovered Obama, the younger generation, people from 18 to 30, a hunger for that kind of beyond yourself commitment. And he is prepared to call that out of us. And the one of the major failures of the Bush administration is not just that it put the Iraq budget off to the side, but it put the whole sense of service off to the side, and was afraid to ask anything of us other than the pursuit of our own profits.
Go shopping.
Yeah. With regard to Washington, I mean, I think that the moment when Obama is using there at Valley Forge is the moment when the viability and the survivability of the American Republic was at the greatest risk in all of American history. And the Army did stay together. A lot of those soldiers at Valley Forge were not representative Americans, not yeoman farmer. They were indentured servants, ex-slaves. 10% of the Continental Army was African American. It was in integrated units. Next time that's going to happen in American history is the Korean War. And after the war was over, Washington said, if you want to tell the story of the of this war, if you actually tell the truth, it will sound like fiction, and no one will believe it, because no one will believe that a group of poor and starving soldiers hung together throughout 7.5 long years of war. It was one of the longest wars in American history. At the end of the war, when the armies encamped at Newburgh, New York, waiting to hear news of the treaty, the troops are on the verge of mutiny because they haven't been paid. The pension that has been promised them is obviously not going to be given. There's talk of marching on Philadelphia and demanding their rights and perhaps making Washington the new monarch. And after all, I mean, that's what Julius Caesar did, and that's what Cromwell did, and that's what Napoleon did. And Washington orders a meeting of all the officers, 503 officers in this big building in Newburgh, and delivers one of the great speeches in American history, in which he essentially says that if we were to do what you want, we would be repudiating everything we've been fighting for. And he pulls a pair of eyeglasses out of his breast pocket, and recently given to him by David Rittenhouse, a scientist in Philadelphia. They never seen him with eyeglasses before, and he puts them on, and he says, "Excuse me, gentlemen, but I have grown blind as well as gray in service to my country." Mm-hmm. And they all start to cry.
Mm-hmm.
Washington then goes down to Annapolis to surrender his sword, a symbolic recognition of civil control of the military, and of at the ball, everybody, they say the women are lined up to get a touch of him. And at the end of the ball, the horses are at the door. He's gone. And it's probably the greatest exit in American history. And Washington's exercise of power is extraordinarily impressive. But even more impressive is the way in which he surrenders it, and a recognition that no matter how indispensable any man in American history is, all men are disposable, and the larger purposes of the nation have to take precedence. I think that those are the kind of origins that we have that Barack, as perhaps as much as any person in American presidential history, has read about and deeply internalized, and is linking himself to that particular tradition.
And he is making an extraordinary and respectful balance, as Washington did, between the need for a military when used properly and not abused, and the integration of that with the higher service to the national civilian, we might say, or civic good. And one of the things that occurred in that paragraph of the speech that I quoted, he talked about how the fallen heroes who lie in Arlington whisper through the ages, we honor them, not only because they are guardians of our liberty, but because they embody the spirit of service, a willingness to find meaning in something greater than themselves. And that is one of the key points that's been quoted in many editorials in the last couple of days, the finding meaning in something greater than themselves. And there have been editorials that have talked about why the young people have migrated to Obama is because there is this yearning, as we felt in my generation, mm-hmm. when we listened to Jack Kennedy talk about the Peace Corps, talk about the Alliance for Progress. There was this sense of international service, not just to our country, but also internationally. And all of that was broken apart in the most brutal way by the Vietnam War, which divided generation and generation and, in effect, gave a really bad name to the military. And yet, here at this point in time, we have to find some kind of way to do the three Ds, what Obama was talking about yesterday, defense, development, and diplomacy. And we had people at the State Department yesterday cheering wildly that here we now had a president in office that was going to actually make use of the Foreign Service and the skills that they have developed, which are non-military in nature, but have to do with, at its best, understanding and communicating with with other cultures and other points of view. The so-called diplomatic service is not there to be manipulative cookie pushers in striped pants, as they're frequently ridiculed by an ignorant segment of the population, particularly the Congress, but it's there to actually be of a higher service, just in the way that we sent Ben Franklin to Paris, for instance.
I think that the reference to the Arlington Cemetery folk, and my father's buried there, echoes the line in Lincoln's inaugural Mystic Chords of Memory that tie us back. He was referring to the revolutionary generation and those soldiers. And Obama is touching that theme himself and reaching all the way back. And in that sense, he's so connected to the deeper resonances of American history. On the other hand, he's blissfully free of the kind of ideological convictions that respond in the 60s in the wake of the Vietnam War and the hatred that grew up on both sides, both on the anti-war movement and those people who were not necessarily supporting the war, but saw the anti-war movement as kind of left-wing sickness. He has come after that. He didn't grow through that, and those old fights are irrelevant to him. He can call us together in a way without that kind of baggage, because it's never been a part of his own life.
This is an excellent point. And so, Joe, I want to follow up on what you've just said here with that most interesting point, and also say that my mother is buried at Arlington Cemetery. My father, who celebrates his birthday at 95 next month, he will be buried there, as well as a naval officer, a career naval officer. So I just want to say that I feel that Barack is really the one that can heal our Vietnam wound. I had hoped that it would be John Kerry, my classmate from college, because he had gone into the service. He had gotten heroic medals for his service, which were then really demeaned by the swift boating campaign and so on. That was really a total disgrace. But at the same time, he came back and headed up Vietnam Vets Against the War, one of the leaders of that. So I thought, well, here's a man, John Kerry, who in his own biography has both sides of this conflict, but it just didn't work. He was mercilessly attacked. He had not really, in a sense, I feel in later reflection, integrated it in his own person. And interestingly enough, Andrew Sullivan, in that very well-known article in the fall of 2007, in the December article of The Atlantic, said that Barack Obama, who I was a very early supporter of, and so was Andrew Sullivan, was really the one he was backing in this election, because at 47, he was free of all the baggage of your generation, my generation, all the people in the last three or four decades who were in the 60s, because in the 60s, you were on one side or the other of what has come to be known as the cultural divide. And so it's become clear to us now in historical perspective that no one within that dichotomy or dynamic, no one in the baby boomer generation itself, was able to heal that wound. And here we have this young man with this almost preternatural depth of historical understanding, who himself has not been in the military, is younger than the whole Vietnam Fisher generation, and is able to bring a healing voice and a respectful approach to the service aspect of the military, which I'm sure you honor in your own father, and I honor in my father, who was a war hero in World War II, a member of the Greatest Generation. But I could not get through a dinner during the Vietnam War when I was home visiting. I would just have to get up and leave the table, because the conflict between us was so strong. And so here's an opportunity where all of us, I think, can really imagine the possibility of a great healing. And when I called my father after the inauguration, I didn't know what he would say, because he's usually a loyal supporter of whoever the president is, even when Bush was president. And he said, I thought it was great. I thought everything about it was great. It was a great day. And I was just so delighted.
Well, my mother's buried with my father there. I guess that's something that was allowed for a while, the spouses of former veterans. And
It's still allowed, yes.
Is it still allowed?
Yes. Yeah. I was just there the other day, and they have both under the same marker.
Right. I would just repeat what you were saying. I do think that we've turned a page, and that what you said about Kerry, I supported Kerry, but I was disappointed in his candidacy. And there's some undefinable quality that he doesn't have and Barack Obama has.
That's right.
And that I first encountered in reading Obama's two books.
Oh, exactly.
Just when he was starting to become a candidate, before it was fashionable, I thought, oh, my God, this is a person who is capable of using the English language in a way that suggests a cogency and a depth of understanding that you certainly you just don't expect of mainstream political candidates anymore. And I mean, and then to survive a two-year campaign in which madness is the day-by-day experience and the kind of instant news, face up against the window pane, soundbite wisdom, and yet he retains a depth in the midst of that kind of extraordinarily superficial political culture, a depth that is discernible. And that's the reason, I believe, the reason he was able to win the election.
Ed, that's right. Even David Brooks, the conservative commentator, was one of the earliest persons to observe that he had this calm and equanimity, which was the great envy, actually, of many people and caused a certain amount of jealousy and also a tremendous amount of admiration that he could actually keep that equanimity. And it was more than just cool. It's been commented upon that he has a certain cool, but yet that notion of cool was written about in the Washington Post, by the way, in a very interesting article by a man named Henry Allen, who said that there's a Yoruba word for this called ititu, and it means cool, but not in the sense of a cool cat with shades on and sort of hip and different from somebody else, but someone who has a great equanimity and a certain kind of warm charisma, paradoxically, because of this equanimity. So cool doesn't mean distant or cold in this higher sense. It does mean something of a profound equanimity that can hold the space for the passions and the conflicts and oftentimes the confusion of competing points of view. And this is what I think is really an aspect of the younger generation that they are yearning for, because who is not tired of the endless pettiness and polarization of our politics for the last four decades? Imagine people of Barack's age and younger. That's all they've ever seen. They've never seen a Jack Kennedy or a Bobby Kennedy or a Martin Luther King that had the inspirational ability to touch people's hearts, which is actually the deep etymological meaning of the word charisma. And so one of the things, again, to talk about David Brooks that was interesting is that he, as a conservative commentator on January 20, the day of the inauguration, he wrote something in the New York Times called The Politics of Cohesion, in which I saw, even though he didn't say this and he may not get it, but I saw that the reason why the younger generation went for Reagan was that in the tremendous eruption of cultural change, much of it for the better. You know, the civil rights movement that I participated in, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, these were all eruptions in the conventional order of the 50s, the post-World War II 50s, and they were necessary revolutions. Jack Kennedy himself said, change always disturbs. People forget that when James Meredith, or maybe they never knew because it wasn't taught in the history class, that when James Meredith wanted to be the first black student to integrate the University of Mississippi, the crowds were so unruly that two people were killed on that day trying to protest and prevent him from actually getting into the university. By contrast, here when Obama spoke with this great equanimity, 2 million people, and I was right there among them, gathered under an enormous logistical challenge of metros and subways and so on without a single arrest.
Isn't that amazing?
It has never happened in the history of the world.
If you get 2 million people in one place, it's almost inevitable that you're going to have conflicts, you're going to have some kind of spats, and the notion that the electromagnetic field that Obama seems to be able to create around that audience and around himself imposed a level of civility that precluded any acts that the police were going to have to make arrests for. That is, I mean, if somebody said that was going to happen, I would have said that's impossible. And I do think that this sense of equanimity that you have, this, you know, the familiar line, comfortable in his own skin, the fact that it's a black skin makes it even more historically significant, of course, but that there is a depth there that has its roots in an understanding of history, but he also conveys the sense that he knows where history is headed, and that when the static in the system becomes cacophonous, he becomes super calm because he knows, he conveys this. This is, you know, eerie, but he knows, you know, he doesn't have to attack McCain. He knows that he doesn't have to respond to these things because he knows he's going to win, and he knows the direction in which he wishes to take the country and the way in which history is compelling him to take it. So that sense, somebody said that a great leader has to have history in his bones and blood, and he has it.
Not only does he have it, but he gives over time the great example that he walks his talk, something we have not seen in politicians, again, in three or four decades. In the 19th century, this was, of course, one of the problems that Mark Twain spoke eloquently about when he said, we only have one indigenous criminal class, and that is the U.S. Congress. And he was speaking in an H.L. Mencken kind of way, but there was definitely a very large kernel of truth in there, because people from time immemorial have seen the political path as a way to personal power and a way to personal aggrandizement. So it is the rare person, as you say, like Washington, who accedes to power with a real sense of humility and service and then surrenders power in the same way. And he set that kind of example, but unfortunately it has not been pursued in recent memory with that kind of sense of a higher purpose. And so I think what really was very interesting about Barack talking about power in his inaugural address is this paragraph, which I'd like to quote. He says, recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism not just with missiles and tanks, but with sturdy alliances and enduring convictions. They understood that our power alone cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Now, remember when George Bush Sr. was asked, what does it mean that the Cold War has ended? He famously said, what we say goes. That's what it means. And his son then actually enacted that in a completely extreme way. But Obama then continues and says, instead of thinking that our power entitles us to do as we please, he says, instead, these earlier generations knew that our power grows through its prudent use. Our security emanates from the justness of our cause, the force of our example, and the tempering qualities of humility and restraint. And so this recalls JFK's foreign policy of vigilance, patience, and restraint, and so on. So there is this sense that we really have made a major transformational shift. And to revisit this David Brooks article about the younger generation, he said that the generation of young people in Reagan was looking for some kind of a definiteness in all of the confusion that emanated from the 60s. They looked to the avuncular grandfatherly Reagan, and they saw someone who could give order to their uncertain lives. But then the Reagan Revolution devolved, of course, into what happened with George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, George W., and so on, into this crisis that has really created now the ground for a new way of looking for order. And that is where we can participate beyond polarity, beyond this sense of constant demonization of the other, and looking to Barack Obama as one does in the psyche, in Jungian psychology, for instance, the fairy tales where you've got a king and a queen, they represent that sovereign aspect of our consciousness where it mirrors back to us some kind of nobility or reassurance at its best, or it can be tyrannical and divisive at its worst. And here we have now not only Barack Obama, but an intact family in the White House that is, in a sense, mirroring back this possibility that we can go beyond.
The most famous line from Reagan's first inaugural was the line, government is not the solution, government is the problem.
Exactly.
And I think to some extent George W. Bush's administration represents an extension of that Reagan position. removal of regulations over the financial industry, an attempt to privatize Social Security, do away with as much of the New Deal as possible. I think with Obama, it's now self-evident to most people, to use a good Jeffersonian term, that we need to think of the government not as them, but as us. And Obama embodies that us more eloquently than any other candidate in modern memory.
And remember, this is a young man who, when he was in high school at Punahou, was basically putting his energy into basketball, doing a little exploratory recreational drug use that he wrote about very candidly in his own autobiography, and basically a person at loose ends who didn't really find his connection to history, to reading, to a sense of higher purpose until he got to college. And then he became very, very reflective, spending a great deal of time alone in his room reading in New York City and Columbia, and then became a community organizer, a term which was vilified and mocked at the Republican convention by Rudy Giuliani and Sarah Palin. So the extraordinary shift that has happened here cannot be underestimated. I mean, this is a transformational moment that really we have only seen in the 20th century on VE Day or VJ Day, this sense of celebration that seemingly endless and perverse conflict at many levels has ended. And I'm going to quote once again from President Obama's inaugural address, where he says, "People have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage. What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works. Whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, the programs will end. And those of us who manage the public dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day. Because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government." End of quote. And one of the things that Barack Obama has said in the last 2 days that he has said repeatedly is that he is not interested in ideology. And I think the younger generation really responds that we want something that works. We don't want people acting out of preconceived ideas or ideological loyalties. And he has said that very directly, that I will look at everything and I will see what works for our common purpose.
He's a pragmatist with principles, and far from being the kind of extraordinary, you know, as he was painted by the Republicans during the campaign as the sort of super liberal. At his core, Obama's really a Burkean conservative, and understands that sometimes the pace of change has to be, as the famous court decision put it, all deliberate speed. I think that we'll see that in likely the way which health care is handled, that I don't think he believes he can get a single-payer system in one gulp, but I think he's going to move towards it with all deliberate speed. I'm going to say that the most interesting picture I've seen of Obama is the current cover of The New Yorker, where Obama is dressed in an 18th-century wig and made to look like some combination of either George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, and there's a kind of this linkage back to the 18th century certainly does my heart the good, because I do think that's the place where it all started, and that Obama's presidency represents the continued fulfillment of the promises we made to ourselves back then.
That's beautifully stated, Joe, and I think it's a dialogue, as we've had here today, and a dialogue with the American people, where he said, "My faith in the future that we can do anything we set our mind to comes directly from my experience in the last 2 years on the campaign trail, my experience in community organizing. It is you who have given me Barack Obama, the faith and the perseverance to go forward. And so he really embodies this ability to convey that it is we together, yes, we can, and not he who will lead us out of the darkness. And so, Joe, for your entire life work and your major contribution to understanding, so I want to deeply honor and thank you.
Thank you for having me again.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. Be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. And visit us on my website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. And if you'd like to listen freely to additional archived visionary dialogues with myself and other transformational thinkers listed on my livingdialogues.com website, once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. Or simply browse through the list of programs here whenever you like, download them, or listen to them on your computer. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.